did not get out of her carriage, but her liveryman, in spatterdashes, a cape and black high hat, jumped off at the entrance. "I'm going. Goodbye," said Anna, and kissing her son, she went up to Alexey Alexandrovich and held out her hand to him. "It was ever so lovely of you to come." Alexey Alexandrovich kissed her hand. "Well, au revoir, then. You'll come back for some tea? That'll be delightful," she said, and went out, radiant and gay. But as soon as he was out of sight, she became aware of the spot on her hand that his lips had touched, and she shuddered with repulsion. Chapter 28. When Alexey Alexandrovich reached the racecourse, Anna was already sitting in the pavilion beside Betsy, in that pavilion where the highest society had gathered. She caught sight of her husband in the distance. Two men, her husband and her lover, were the two centers of her existence, and unaided by her external senses, she was aware of their proximity. She was aware of her husband approaching a long way off, and she could not help following him in the surging crowd in the midst of which he was moving. She watched his progress toward the pavilion, saw him now responding condescendingly to an ingratiating bow, now exchanging friendly, nonchalant greetings with his equals, now assiduously trying to catch the eye of some great one of this world, and taking off his big round hat that pressed down the tips of his ears. All these ways of his she knew, and all were hateful to her. "Nothing but ambition, nothing but desire to get on. That's all there is in his soul," she thought. "As for his lofty ideals, love of culture, religion, they are only so many tools for getting on." From his glances toward the ladies' pavilion, he was staring straight at her, but did not distinguish his wife in the sea of muslin, ribbons, feathers, parasols, and flowers. She saw that he was looking for her, but she purposely avoided noticing him. "Alexey Alexandrovich," Princess Betsy called to him. "I'm sure you don't see your wife, but here she is." He smiled his chilly smile. "There's so much splendor here that one's eyes are dazzled," he said, and he went into the pavilion. He smiled to his wife as a man should smile on meeting his wife after only just parting from her, and greeted the princess and other acquaintances, giving to each what was due, that is to say, jesting with the ladies and dealing out friendly greetings among the men. Below, near the pavilion, was standing an adjutant general of whom Alexey Alexandrovich had a high opinion, noted for his intelligence and culture. Alexey Alexandrovich entered into conversation with him. There was an interval between the races, and so nothing hindered conversation. The adjutant general expressed his disapproval of races. Alexey Alexandrovich replied, defending them. Anna heard his high, measured tones without losing one word, and every word struck her as false and stabbed her ears with pain. When the four versus the steeplechase was beginning, she bent forward and gazed with fixed eyes at Vronsky as he went up to his horse and mounted, and at the same time she heard that loathsome, never-ceasing voice of her husband. She was in an agony of terror for Vronsky, but a still greater agony was the never-ceasing, as it seemed to her, stream of her husband's shrill voice with its familiar intonations. "I'm a wicked woman, a lost woman," she thought, "but I don't like lying. I can't endure falsehood. While as for him, her husband, falsehood is the breath of life to him. He knows all about it. He sees it all. What does he care if he can talk so calmly? If he were to kill me, if he were to kill Vronsky, I might respect him. No, all he wants is falsehood and propriety," Anna said to herself, not considering exactly what it was she wanted of her husband and how she would have liked to see him behave. She did not understand either that Alexey Alexandrovich's peculiar loquacity that day, so exasperating to her, was merely the expression of his inward distress and uneasiness. As a child that has been hurt hops about, putting all his muscles into movement to drown the pain, in the same way Alexey Alexandrovich needed mental exercise to drown the thoughts of his wife, that in her presence and in Vronsky's, and with the continual iteration of his name, would force themselves on his attention. And it is as natural for a child to hop about as it was natural for him to talk well and cleverly. He was saying, Danger in the races to officers, to cavalrymen, is an essential element in the race. If England can point to the most brilliant feats of cavalry in military history, it is simply owing to the fact that she has historically developed this force both in beasts and in men. Sport has, in my opinion, a great value, and as is always the case, we see nothing but what is most superficial. It's not superficial, said Princess Tverskaya. One of the officers, they say, has broken two ribs. Alexei Alexandrovich smiled his smile, which uncovered his teeth, but revealed nothing more. We'll admit, Princess, that that's not superficial, he said, but internal. But that's not the point. And he turned again to the general with whom he talked seriously. We mustn't forget that those who are taking part in the race are military men, who have chosen that career. And one must allow that every calling has its disagreeable side. It forms an integral part of the duties of an officer. Low sports, such as prize fighting or Spanish bullfights, are a sign of barbarity. But specialized trials of skill are a sign of development. No, I shan't come another time. It's too upsetting, said Princess Betsy. Isn't it, Anna? It is upsetting, but one can't tear oneself away, said another lady. If I'd been a Roman woman, I should never have missed a single circus. Anna said nothing, and keeping her opera glass up, gazed always at the same spot. At that moment, a tall general walked through the pavilion. Breaking off what he was saying, Alexei Alexandrovich got up hurriedly, though with dignity, and bowed low to the general. You're not racing? The officer asked, chafing him. My race is a harder one, Alexei Alexandrovich responded deferentially. And though the answer meant nothing, the general looked as though he had heard a witty remark from a witty man, and fully relished la pointe de la sauce. There are two aspects, Alexei Alexandrovich resumed, those who take part and those who look on. And love for such spectacles is an unmistakable proof of a low degree of development in the spectator. I admit, but... Any bets, Princess? Sounded Stepan Arkadyevich's voice from below, addressing Betsy. Who's your favorite? Anna and I are for Kuzovlev, replied Betsy. I'm for Vronsky. A pair of gloves? Done. But it is a pretty sight, isn't it? Alexei Alexandrovich paused while the others were talking near him, but he began again directly. I admit that manly sports do not, he made an attempt to continue. But at that moment the racers started and all conversation ceased. Alexei Alexandrovich also fell silent and everyone stood up and turned toward the stream. Alexei Alexandrovich took no interest in the race, and so he did not watch the racers, but fell listlessly to scanning the spectators with his weary eyes. His eyes rested upon Anna. Her face was white and stern. She was obviously seeing nothing and no one but one man. Her hand had convulsively clutched her fan, and she held her breath. He looked at her and hastily turned away, scrutinizing other faces. But here's this lady, too, and others very much moved as well. It's very natural, Alexei Alexandrovich told himself. He tried not to look at her, but unconsciously his eyes were drawn to her. He examined that face again, trying not to read what was so plainly written on it, and against his own will, with horror, read in it what he did not want to know. The first fall, Kuzovlev's, at the stream, agitated everyone. But Alexei Alexandrovich saw distinctly on Anna's pale, triumphant face that the man she was watching had not fallen. When, after Makotin and Vronsky had cleared the worst barrier, the next officer had been thrown straight on his head at it and fatally injured, and a shudder of horror passed over the whole public, Alexei Alexandrovich saw that Anna did not even notice it, and had some difficulty in realizing what they were saying round her. But more and more often, and with greater persistence, he watched her. Anna, wholly engrossed as she was with the sight of Vronsky racing, became aware of her husband's cold eyes fixed upon her from aside. She glanced round for an instant, looked inquiringly at him, and with a slight frown turned away again. Ah, I don't care, she seemed to say to him, and she did not once glance at him again. The race was an unlucky one, and of the 17 officers who rode in it, more than half had been thrown and hurt. Toward the end of the race, everyone was in a state of agitation, which was intensified by the fact that the Tsar was displeased. Chapter 29. Everyone was loudly expressing disapprobation. Everyone was repeating a phrase someone had uttered. The lions and gladiators will be the next thing. And everyone was feeling horrified, so that when Vronsky fell to the ground and Anna moaned aloud, there was nothing very much out of the way in it. But afterward a change came over Anna's face, which really went beyond decorum. She utterly lost her head. She began fluttering like a caged bird, at one moment wanting to get up and move away, and at the next turning to Betsy. Let us go, she said. But Betsy did not hear her. She was bending down, talking to a general who had come up to her. Alexei Alexandrovich went up to Anna and courteously offered her his arm. Let us go if you like, he said in French, but Anna was listening to the general and did not notice her husband. He's broken his leg too, so they say, the general was saying. This surpasses everything. Without answering her husband, Anna lifted her opera glass and gazed toward the place where Vronsky had fallen, but it was so far off and there was such a crowd of people about it, she could make out nothing. She put down the opera glass and would have moved away, but at that moment an officer galloped up and made some announcement to the Tsar. Anna craned forward, listening. Stiva, Stiva, she cried to her brother. But her brother did not hear her. Again, she would have moved away. Once more I offer you my arm if you want to be going, said Alexei Alexandrovich, reaching for her hand. She drew back from him with aversion and without looking at his face answered, No, no, leave me alone. I'll stay. She saw now that from the place of Vronsky's accident, an officer was running across the course toward the pavilion. Betsy waved her handkerchief to him. The officer brought the news that the rider was not killed, but that the back of the horse had been broken. On hearing this, Anna sat down hurriedly and hid her face in her fan. Alexei Alexandrovich saw that she was weeping and could not control her tears, nor even the sobs that were shaking her bosom. Alexei Alexandrovich stood so as to screen her, giving her time to recover herself. For the third time I offer you my arm, he said to her after a short interval, turning to her. Anna gazed at him and did not know what to say. Princess Betsy came to her rescue. No, Alexei Alexandrovich, I brought Anna and I promised to take her home, put in Betsy. Excuse me, princess, he said, smiling courteously, but looking very firmly in the face. But I see that Anna's not very well, and I wish her to come home with me. Anna looked about her in a frightened way, got up submissively, and laid her hand on her husband's arm. I'll send to him and find out and let you know, Betsy whispered to her. As they left the pavilion, Alexei Alexandrovich, as always, talked to those he met. And Anna had, as always, to talk and answer. But she was utterly beside herself and moved, hanging on her husband's arm as though in a dream. Is he killed or not? Is it true? Will he come or not? Shall I see him today? She was thinking. She took her seat in her husband's carriage in silence and in silence drove out of the press of carriages. In spite of all he had seen, Alexei Alexandrovich still did not allow himself to consider his wife's real condition. He merely saw the outward symptoms. He saw that she was behaving unbecomingly and considered it his duty to tell her so. But it was very difficult for him not to say more, to tell her nothing but that. He opened his mouth to tell her she had behaved unbecomingly, but he could not help saying something utterly different. What an inclination we all have, though, for these cruel spectacles, he said. I observe. Eh, I don't understand, said Anna contemptuously. He was offended and at once began to say what he had meant to say. I am obliged to tell you, he began. So now we are to have it out, she thought, and she felt frightened. I am obliged to tell you that your behavior has been unbecoming today, he said to her in French. In what way has my behavior been unbecoming, she said aloud, turning her head swiftly and looking him straight in the face, not with the bright expression that seemed covering something, but with a look of determination under which she concealed with difficulty the dismay she was feeling. Be careful, he said, pointing to the open window opposite the coachman. He got up and pulled up the window. What did you consider unbecoming, she repeated. the despair you were unable to conceal at the accident of one of the riders. He waited for her to retort, but she was silent, looking straight before her. I have already begged you so to conduct yourself in society that even malicious tongues can find nothing to say against you. There was a time when I spoke of your inward attitude, but I am not speaking of that now. Now I speak only of your external attitude. You have behaved improperly, and I would wish it not to occur again. She did not hear half of what he was saying. She felt panic-stricken before him, and was thinking whether it was true that Vronsky was not killed. Was it of him they were speaking when they said the rider was unhurt, but that the back of the horse had been broken? She merely smiled with a forced smile when he finished and made no reply, because she had not heard what he said. Alexey Alexandrovich had begun to speak boldly, but as he realized plainly what he was speaking of, the dismay she was feeling infected him too. He saw the smile, and a strange misapprehension came over him. She is smiling at my suspicions. Yes, she will tell me directly what she told me before, that there was no foundation for my suspicions, that the whole thing is absurd. At that moment, rather than revelation of everything was hanging over him, there was nothing he expected so much as that she would answer mockingly, as before, that his suspicions were absurd and utterly groundless. So terrible to him was what he knew that now he was ready to believe anything. But the expression of her face, scared and gloomy, did not now promise even deception. Possibly I was mistaken, said he. If so, I beg your pardon. No, you were not mistaken, she said slowly, looking desperately into his frigid face. You were not mistaken. I was in despair, nor could I help being in despair. I am listening to you, but I am thinking of him. I love him. I am his mistress. I can't bear you. I am afraid of you, and I hate you. You can do what you like to me. And dropping back into the corner of the carriage, she broke into sobs, hiding her face in her hands. Alexey Alexandrovich did not stir and kept looking straight before him. But his whole face suddenly bore the solemn rigidity of the dead, and his expression did not change during the whole time of the drive home. On reaching the house, he turned his head to her, still with the same expression. Very well, but I expect a strict observance of the external forms of propriety, till such time, his voice shook, as I may take measures to secure my honor and communicate them to you. He got out first and helped her to get out. Before the servants, he pressed her hand, took his seat in the carriage, and drove back to Petersburg. Immediately afterward, a footman came from Princess Betsy and brought Anna a note. I sent to Alexey to find out how he is, and he writes me. He is quite well and unhurt, but in despair. So he will be here, she thought. What a good thing I told him all. She glanced at her watch. She had still 3 hours to wait, and the memories of their last meeting set her blood in flame. My God, how light it is. It's dreadful, but I do love to see his face, and I do love this fantastic light. My husband? Oh, yes. Well, thank God, everything's at an end with him. Chapter 30. In the little German watering place to which the Shcherbatskys had betaken themselves, as in all places indeed where people are gathered together, the usual process, as it were, of the crystallization of society went on, assigning to each member of that society a definite and unalterable place. Just as the particle of water in frost definitely and unalterably takes the special form of the crystal of snow, so each new person that arrived at the springs was at once placed in his or her peculiar place. First, Shcherbatsky, Samt Gemahlin und Tochter, by the apartments they took, and from their name and from the friends they made, were immediately crystallized into a definite place marked out for them. There was visiting the watering place that year a real German Fürsten, in consequence of which the crystallizing process went on more vigorously than ever. Princess Shcherbatsky wished above everything to present her daughter to this German princess, and the day after their arrival she duly performed this rite. Kitty made a low and graceful curtsy in the very simple, that is to say, very elegant frock that had been ordered for her from Paris. The German princess said, "I hope the roses will soon come back to this pretty little face." And for the Shcherbatskaya, certain definite lines of existence were at once laid down, from which there was no departing. The Shcherbatskys made the acquaintance too of the family of an English lady and of a German countess and her son, wounded in the last war, and of a learned Swede, and of Mazur Knut and his sister. Yet inevitably the Shcherbatskys were thrown most into the society of a Moscow lady, Maria Eugenievna Ritisheva, and her daughter, whom Kitty disliked, because she had fallen ill like herself over a love affair, and the Moscow colonel, whom Kitty had known from childhood, and had always seen in uniform and epaulettes, and who now, with his little eyes and his open neck and flowered cravat, was uncommonly ridiculous and tedious, because there was no getting rid of him. When all this was so firmly established, Kitty began to be very much bored, especially as the prince went off to Carlsbad and she was left alone with her mother. She took no interest in the people she knew, feeling that nothing fresh would come of them. Her chief mental interest in the watering place consisted in watching and making theories about the people she did not know. It was characteristic of Kitty that she always imagined everything in people in the most favorable light possible, especially so in those she did not know. And now, as she made surmises as to who people were, what were their relations to one another, and what they were like, Kitty endowed them with the most marvelous and noble characters, and found confirmation in her observations. Of these people, the one that attracted her most was a Russian girl who had come to the watering place with an invalid Russian lady, Madame Stahl, as everyone called her. Madame Stahl belonged to the highest society, but she was so ill she could not walk, and only on exceptionally fine days made her appearance at the spring in an invalid carriage. But it was not so much from ill health as from pride. So Princess Shcherbatsky interpreted it, that Madame Stahl had not made the acquaintance of anyone among the Russians there. The Russian girl looked after Madame Stahl, and besides that, she was, as Kitty observed, on friendly terms with all the invalids who were seriously ill, and there were many of them at the springs, and was solicitous over them in the most natural way. This Russian girl was not, as Kitty gathered, related to Madame Stahl, nor was she a paid attendant. Madame Stahl called her Varenka, and other people called her Mademoiselle Varenka. Apart from the interest Kitty took in this girl's relations with Madame Stahl and with other unknown persons, Kitty, as often happened, felt an inexplicable attraction to Mademoiselle Varenka, and was aware when their eyes met that she too liked her. Of Mademoiselle Varenka, one would not say that she had passed her first youth, but she was, as it were, a creature without youth. She might have been taken for 19 or for 30. If her features were criticized separately, she was handsome rather than plain, in spite of the sickly hue of her face. Hers would have been a good figure, too, if it had not been for her extreme thinness and the size of her head, which was too large for her medium height. But she was not likely to be attractive to men. She was like a fine flower already past its bloom and without fragrance, though the petals were still unwithered. Moreover, she would have been unattractive to men also from the lack of just what Kitty had too much of the suppressed fire of vitality and the consciousness of her own attractiveness. She always seemed absorbed in work beyond a doubt, and so it seemed as if she would take no interest in anything outside it. It was just this contrast with her own position that was for Kitty the great attraction of Mademoiselle Varenka. Kitty felt that in her manner of life, she would find an example of what she was now so painfully seeking. Interest in life, a dignity in life, apart from the worldly relations of girls with men, which so revolted Kitty, and appeared to her now as a shameful exhibition of goods in search of a purchaser. The more attentively Kitty watched her unknown friend, the more convinced she was that this girl was the perfect creature she fancied her, and the more eagerly she wished to make her acquaintance. The two girls used to meet several times a day, and every time they met, Kitty's eyes said, "Who are you? What are you? Are you really the exquisite creature I imagine you to be? But for goodness sakes, don't suppose," her eyes added, "that I would force my acquaintance on you. I simply admire you and like you. I like you, too, and you're very, very sweet, and I should like you better still, if I had time," answered the eyes of the unknown girl. Kitty saw, indeed, that she was always busy. Either she was taking the children of a Russian family home from the Springs, or fetching a shawl for a sick lady and wrapping her up in it, or trying to interest an irritable invalid, or selecting and buying tea cakes for someone. Soon after the arrival of the Shcherbatskys, there appeared in the morning crowd at the Spring two persons who attracted universal and unfavorable attention. They were a tall man with a stooping figure and huge hands in an old coat too short for him, with black, simple, and yet terrible eyes, and a pockmarked, kind-looking woman, very badly and tastelessly dressed. Recognizing these persons as Russians, Kitty had already in her imagination begun constructing a delightful and touching romance about them. But the princess, having ascertained from the Kurlitz that this was Nikolai Levin and Maria Nikolaevna, explained to Kitty what a bad man this Levin was, and all her fancies about these two people vanished, not so much from what her mother told her as from the fact that it was Konstantin's brother. This pair suddenly seemed to Kitty in the highest degree unpleasant. This Levin, with his continual twitching of his head, aroused in her now an irrepressible feeling of disgust. It seemed to her that his big, terrible eyes, which persistently pursued her, expressed a feeling of hatred and contempt, and she tried to avoid meeting him. Chapter 31. It was a foul day. It had been raining all the morning, and the invalids with their parasols had flocked into the arcades. Kitty was walking there with her mother and the Moscow colonel, smart and jaunty in his European coat, bought ready-made at Frankfurt. They were walking on one side of the arcade, trying to avoid Levin, who was walking on the other side. Varenka, in her dark dress and a black hat with a turned-down brim, was walking up and down the whole length of the arcade with a blind French woman, and every time she met Kitty, they exchanged friendly glances. "Mama, couldn't I speak to her?" said Kitty, watching her unknown friend, and noticing that she was going up to the Spring and that they might come there together. "Oh, if you want to so much, I'll find out about her first and make her acquaintance myself," answered her mother. "But what do you see in her out of the way?" "A companion, most probably. If you like, I'll make acquaintance with Madame Stahl. I used to know her Valsour," added the princess, lifting her head haughtily. Kitty knew that the princess was offended because Madame Stahl had apparently avoided making her acquaintance. Kitty did not insist. "How wonderfully sweet she is," she said, gazing at Varenka just as she handed a glass to the Frenchwoman. "Look how natural and sweet it all is." "It's so funny to see your engoumens," said the princess. "No, we'd better go back," she added, noticing Levin coming toward them with his companion and a German doctor to whom he was talking, very noisily and angrily. They turned to go back when suddenly they heard not merely noisy talk, but actual shouting. Levin, stopping short, was shouting at the doctor, and the doctor, too, was excited. A crowd gathered about them. The princess and Kitty beat a hasty retreat, while the colonel joined the crowd to find out what was up. A few minutes later, the colonel overtook them. "What was it?" inquired the princess. "Scandalous and disgraceful," answered the colonel. "The one thing to be dreaded is meeting Russians abroad. That tall gentleman was abusing the doctor, flinging all sorts of insults at him because he wasn't treating him quite as he liked, and he began waving his stick at him. It's simply scandalous." "Oh, how unpleasant," said the princess. "Well, and how did it end?" "Luckily, at that point, that miss, the one in the mushroom hat, intervened." "She is a Russian lady, I think," said the colonel. "Mademoiselle Varenka?" Kitty asked joyously. "Yes, yes, she came to the rescue before anyone else. She took the man by the arm and led him away. "There, Mama," said Kitty, "yet you wonder why I'm enthusiastic about her." The next day, as she watched her unknown friend, Kitty noticed that Mademoiselle Varenka was already on the same terms with Levin and his companion as with her other protégés. She went up to them, entered into conversation with them, and served as interpreter for the woman, who could not speak any foreign language. Kitty began to entreat her mother still more urgently to let her make acquaintance with Varenka. And disagreeable as it was to the princess to seem to take the first step in wishing to make the acquaintance of Madame Stahl, who thought fit to give herself airs, she made inquiries about Varenka, and having ascertained particulars about her tending to prove that there could be no harm, even if little good in the acquaintance, she herself approached Varenka and made acquaintance with her. Choosing a time when her daughter had gone to the spring, while Varenka had stopped outside the baker's, the princess approached her. "Allow me to make your acquaintance," she said with her dignified smile. "My daughter has lost her heart to you," she said. "Possibly you do not know me. I am..." "That feeling is more than reciprocal, princess," Varenka answered hurriedly. "What a good deed you did yesterday to our poor compatriot," said the princess. Varenka flushed a little. "I don't remember. I don't think I did anything," she said. "Why, you saved that Levin from disagreeable consequences." "Yes, Sa Kampan called me, and I tried to pacify him. He's very ill and was dissatisfied with the doctor. I'm used to looking after such invalids." "Yes, I heard you live at Mentone with your aunt, I think, Madame Stahl. I used to know her Belle Sœur." "No, she's not my aunt. I call her Mama, but I'm not related to her. I was brought up by her," answered Varenka, flushing a little again. This was so simply said, and so sweet was the truthful and candid expression of her face, that the princess saw why Kitty had taken such a fancy to Varenka. "Well, and what's this Levin going to do?" asked the princess. "He's going away," answered Varenka. At that instant, Kitty came up from the spring, beaming with delight because her mother had become acquainted with her unknown friend. "See, Kitty, your intense desire to make friends with Mademoiselle Varenka," Varenka put in, smiling. "That's what everyone calls me." Kitty blushed with pleasure and slowly, without speaking, squeezed her new friend's hand, which did not respond to her pressure but lay motionless in her hand. The hand did not respond to her pressure, but the face of Mademoiselle Varenka glowed with a soft, glad, though rather mournful smile that showed large but handsome teeth. "I have long wished for this, too," she said. But you are so busy." "Oh, no, I'm not busy at all," answered Varenka. But at that moment she had to leave her new friends because two little Russian girls, children of an invalid, ran up to her. "Varenka, Mama's calling," they cried, and Varenka went after them. Chapter 32. The particulars which the princess had learned to regard into Varenka's past and her relations with Madame Stahl were as follows. Madame Stahl, of whom some people said she had worried her husband out of his life, while others said it was he who had made her wretched by his immoral behavior, had always been a woman of weak health and enthusiastic temperament. When, after her separation from her husband, she gave birth to her only child, the child had died almost immediately, and the family of Madame Stahl, knowing her sensibility and fearing the news would kill her, had substituted another child, a baby born the same night and in the same house in Petersburg, the daughter of the chief cook of the imperial household. This was Varenka. Madame Stahl learned later on that Varenka was not her own child, but she went on bringing her up, especially as very soon afterward Varenka had not a relation of her own living. Madame Stahl had now been living without a break more than 10 years abroad in the South, never leaving her couch. And some people said that Madame Stahl had made her social position as a philanthropic, highly religious woman. Other people said she really was at heart the highly ethical being, living for nothing but the good of her fellow creatures, which she represented herself to be. No one knew what her faith was, Catholic, Protestant, or Orthodox, but one fact was indubitable. She was in amicable relations with the highest dignitaries of all the churches and sects. Varenka lived with her all the while abroad, and everyone who knew Madame Stahl knew and liked Mademoiselle Varenka, as everyone called her. Having learned all these facts, the princess found nothing to object to in her daughter's intimacy with Varenka, more especially as Varenka's breeding and education were of the best. She spoke French and English extremely well, and what was of the most weight brought a message from Madame Stahl expressing her regret that she had been prevented by her ill health from making the acquaintance of the princess. After getting to know Varenka, Kitty became more and more fascinated by her friend, and every day she discovered new virtues in her. The princess, hearing that Varenka had a good voice, asked her to come and sing to them in the evening. "Kitty plays, and we have a piano, not a good one, it's true, but you will give us so much pleasure," said the princess with her affected smile, which Kitty disliked particularly just then, because she noticed that Varenka had no inclination to sing. Varenka came, however, in the evening and brought a roll of music with her. The princess had invited Marya Eugenievna and her daughter and the colonel. Varenka seemed quite unaffected by the presence of persons whom she did not know, and she went directly to the piano. She could not accompany herself, but she could sing music at sight very well. Kitty, who played well, accompanied her. "You have an extraordinary talent," the princess said to her after Varenka had sung the first song excellently. Marya Eugenievna and her daughter expressed their thanks and admiration. "Look," said the colonel, looking out of the window, "what an audience has collected to listen to you." There actually was a considerable crowd under the windows. "I am very glad it gives you pleasure," Varenka answered simply. Kitty looked with pride at her friend. She was enchanted by her talent and her voice and her face, but most of all by her manner, by Varenka's obviously thinking nothing of her singing and being quite unmoved by their praise. She seemed only to be asking, "Am I to sing again, or is that enough?" "If it had been I," thought Kitty, "how proud I should have been, how delighted I should have been to see that crowd under the windows. But she's utterly unmoved by it. Her only motive is to avoid refusing and to please Mama. What is there about her? What is it gives her the power to look down on everything, to be calm independently of everything? How I should like to know it and to learn it from her," thought Kitty, gazing into her serene face. The princess asked Varenka to sing again, and Varenka sang another song, also smoothingly, distinctly, and well, standing erect at the piano and beating time on it with her thin, dark-skinned hand. The next song in the book was an Italian one. Kitty played the opening bars and looked around at Varenka. "Let's skip that," said Varenka, flushing a little. Kitty let her eyes rest on Varenka's face with a look of dismay and inquiry. "Very well, the next one," she said hurriedly, turning over the pages and at once feeling there was something connected with the song. "No," answered Varenka with a smile, laying her hand on the music. "No, let's have that one." And she sang it just as quietly, as coolly, and as well as the others. When she had finished, they all thanked her and went off to tea. Kitty and Varenka went out into the little garden that adjoined the house. "Am I right that you have some reminiscences connected with that song?" said Kitty. "Don't tell me," she added hastily, "only say if I'm right." "No, why not? I'll tell you," said Varenka simply, and without waiting for a reply, she went on. "Yes, it brings up memories, once painful ones. I cared for someone once, and I used to sing him that song." The big, wide-open eyes gazed silently, sympathetically at Varenka. "I cared for him, and he cared for me, but his mother was opposed, and he married another girl. He's living now not far from us, and I see him sometimes. You didn't think I had a love story, too," she said, and there was a faint gleam in her handsome face of that fire which Kitty felt must once have glowed all over her. "I didn't think so? Why, if I were a man, I could never care for anyone else after knowing you. Only I can't understand how he could, to please his mother, forget you and make you unhappy. He had no heart." "Oh, no, he's a very good man, and I'm not unhappy. Quite the contrary, I'm very happy. Well, we shan't be singing any more now," she added, turning toward the house. "How good you are, how good you are," cried Kitty, and stopping her, she kissed her. "If I could only be even a little like you." "Why should you be like anyone? You're lovely as you are," said Varenka, smiling her gentle, weary smile. No, I'm not lovely at all. Come, tell me. Stop a minute. Let's sit down, said Kitty, making her sit down again beside her. Tell me, isn't it humiliating to think that a man has disdained your love, that he hasn't cared for it? But he didn't disdain it. I believe he cared for me. But he was a dutiful son. Yes, but if it hadn't been on account of his mother, if it had been his own doing, said Kitty, feeling she was giving away her secret, and that her face, burning with the flush of shame, had betrayed her already. In that case, he would have done wrong, and I should not have regretted him, answered Varenka, evidently realizing that they were now talking not of her, but of Kitty. But the humiliation, said Kitty, the humiliation one can never forget, never, she said, remembering her look at the last ball during the pause in the music. Where is the humiliation? Why, you did nothing wrong. Worse than wrong, shameful. Varenka shook her head and laid her hand on Kitty's. Why, what's shameful about it? She said. You didn't tell a man who didn't care for you that you loved him, did you? Of course not. I never said a word, but he knew it. No, no, there are looks, there are ways. I can't forget it if I live 100 years. Why so? I don't understand. The whole point is whether you love him now or not, said Varenka, who called everything by its name. I hate him. I can't forgive myself. Why? What for? The shame, the humiliation. Oh, if everyone were as sensitive as you are, said Varenka, there isn't a girl who hasn't been through the same. It's all so unimportant. Why? What is important? Said Kitty, looking into her face with inquisitive wonder. Oh, there's so much that's important, said Varenka, smiling. Why? What? Oh, so much that's more important, answered Varenka, not knowing what to say. But at that instant they heard the princess's voice from the window. Kitty, it's cold. Either get a shawl or come indoors. It really is time to go in, said Varenka, getting up. I have to go on to Madame Berthe's. She asked me to. Kitty held her by the hand, and with passionate curiosity and entreaty in her eyes, asked her, What is it? What is this of such importance that gives you such tranquility? You know. Tell me. But Varenka did not even know what Kitty's eyes were asking her. She merely thought that she had to go see Madame Berthe, too, that evening, and to make haste home in time for Mama's tea at 12 o'clock. She went indoors, collected her music, and saying goodbye to everyone, was about to go. Allow me to see you home, said the colonel. Yes, how can you go alone at a night like this, chimed in the princess. Anyway, I'll send Parasha. Kitty saw that Varenka could hardly restrain a smile at the idea that she needed an escort. No, I always go about alone and nothing ever happens to me, she said, taking her hat. And kissing Kitty once more without saying what was important, she stepped out courageously with the music under her arm and vanished into the twilight of the summer night, bearing away with her her secret of what was important, and what gave her that calm and dignity so much to be envied. Chapter 33. Kitty made the acquaintance of Madame Stahl, too, and this acquaintance, together with her friendship with Varenka, did not merely exercise a great influence on her, it also comforted her in her mental distress. She found this comfort through a completely new world being opened to her by means of this acquaintance, a world having nothing in common with her past, an exalted, noble world from the height of which she could contemplate her past calmly. It was revealed to her that beside the instinctive life to which Kitty had given herself up hitherto, there was a spiritual life. This life was disclosed in religion, but a religion having nothing in common with that one which Kitty had known from childhood, and which found expression in masses and evening services at the widow's home, where one might meet one's friends and in learning by heart Slavonic texts with the priest. This was a lofty, mysterious religion connected with a whole series of noble thoughts and feelings, which one could not merely believe because one was told to believe, but which one could love. Kitty found all this out not from words. Madame Stahl talked to Kitty as to a charming child that one regards with pleasure, as one regards the memory of one's youth. And only once she said in passing that in all human sorrows, nothing gives comfort but love and faith, and that in the sight of Christ's compassion for us, no sorrow is trifling, and immediately talked of other things. But in every gesture of Madame Stahl, in every word, in every heavenly, as Kitty called it, look, and above all, in the whole story of her life, which she heard from Varenka, Kitty recognized that something, that was important, of which till then she had known nothing. Yet, elevated as Madame Stahl's character was, touching as was her story, and exalted and moving as was her speech, Kitty could not help detecting in her some traits which perplexed her. She noticed that when questioning her about her family, Madame Stahl had smiled contemptuously, which was not in accord with Christian meekness. Kitty noticed, too, that when she had found a Catholic priest with her, Madame Stahl had studiously kept her face in the shadow of the lampshade and had smiled in a peculiar way. Trivial as these two observations were, they perplexed her, and she had her doubts as to Madame Stahl. But on the other hand, Varenka, alone in the world, without friends or relations, with a melancholy disappointment in the past, desiring nothing, regretting nothing, was just that perfection of which Kitty dared hardly dream. In Varenka, she realized that one has but to forget oneself and love others, and one will be calm, happy, and good. And that was what Kitty longed to be. Seeing now clearly what was most important, Kitty was not satisfied with being enthusiastic over it. She at once gave herself up with her whole soul to the new life that was opening to her. From Varenka's accounts of the doings of Madame Stahl and other people whom she mentioned, Kitty had already constructed the plan of her own future life. She would, like Madame Stahl's niece, Aline, of whom Varenka had talked to her a great deal, seek out those who were in trouble, wherever she might be living, help them as far as she could, giving them the gospel. She would read the gospel to the sick, to the criminals, to the dying. The idea of reading the gospel to criminals, as Aline did, particularly fascinated Kitty. But all these were secret dreams of which Kitty did not talk either to her mother or to Varenka. While awaiting the time for carrying out her plans on a large scale, however, Kitty, even then at the Springs, where there were so many people ill and unhappy, readily found a chance for practicing her new principles in imitation of Varenka. At first the princess noticed nothing but that Kitty was much under the influence of her engouement, as she called it, for Madame Stahl and still more for Varenka. She saw that Kitty did not merely imitate Varenka in her conduct, but unconsciously imitated her in her manner of walking, of talking, of blinking her eyes. But later on the princess noticed that, apart from this adoration, some kind of serious spiritual change was taking place in her daughter. The princess saw that in the evenings Kitty read a French testament that Madame Stahl had given her, a thing she had never done before, that she avoided society acquaintances and associated with the sick people who were under Varenka's protection, and especially one poor family, that of a sick painter, Petrov. Kitty was unmistakably proud of playing the part of a sister of mercy in that family. All this was well enough, and the princess had nothing to say against it, especially as Petrov's wife was a perfectly respectable woman, and that the German princess, noticing Kitty's devotion, praised her, calling her an angel of consolation. All this would have been very well if there had been no exaggeration. But the princess saw that her daughter was rushing into extremes, and so, indeed, she told her. Il ne faut jamais rien outre, she said to her. Her daughter made her no reply, but in her heart she thought that one could not talk about exaggeration where Christianity was concerned. What exaggeration could there be in the practice of a doctrine wherein one was bidden to turn the other cheek when one was smitten and give one's shirt if one's coat was taken? But the princess disliked this exaggeration and disliked even more the fact that she felt her daughter did not care to show her all her heart. Kitty did, in fact, conceal her new views and feelings from her mother. She concealed them not because she did not respect or did not love her mother, but simply because she was her mother. She would have revealed them to anyone sooner than to her mother. How is it Anna Pavlovna's not been to see us for so long, the princess said one day, referring to Madame Petrov. I've asked her, but she seems put out about something. No, I've not noticed it, Mama, said Kitty, flushing hotly. Is it long since you've been to see them? We intend making an excursion to the mountains tomorrow, answered Kitty. Well, you may go, answered the princess, gazing at her daughter's embarrassed face and trying to guess the cause of her embarrassment. That day Varenka came to dinner and told them that Anna Pavlovna had changed her mind and given up the excursion for the morrow, and the princess noted again that Kitty reddened. Kitty, haven't you had some misunderstanding with the Petrovs, said the princess when they were left alone. Why has she given up sending the children and coming to see us? Kitty answered that nothing had happened between them and that she could not tell why Anna Pavlovna seemed displeased with her. Kitty answered perfectly truthfully. She did not know the reason Anna Pavlovna had changed toward her, but she guessed it. She guessed at something which she could not tell her mother, which she did not put into words to herself. It was one of those things which one knows, but which one can never speak of even to oneself. So terrible and shameful will it be to be mistaken. Again and again she went over in her memory all her relations with the family. She remembered the simple delight expressed on the round, good-natured face of Anna Pavlovna at their meetings. She remembered their secret confabulations about the invalid, their plots to draw him away from the work which was forbidden him, and to get him out of doors, the devotion of the youngest boy who used to call her my Kitty and would not go to bed without her. How lovely it all was. Then she recalled the thin, terribly thin figure of Petrov, with his long neck, in his brown coat, his scant, curly hair, his questioning blue eyes that were so terrible to Kitty at first, and his painful attempts to seem hearty and lively in her presence. She recalled the efforts she had made at first to overcome the repugnance she felt for him, as for all consumptive people, and the pains it had cost her to think of things to say to him. She recalled the timid, softened look with which he gazed at her, and the strange feeling of compassion and awkwardness, and later of a sense of her own goodness which she had felt at it. How lovely it all was, but all that was at first. Now, a few days ago, everything was suddenly spoiled. Anna Pavlovna had met Kitty with affected cordiality, and had kept continual watch on her and on her husband. Could that touching pleasure he showed when she came near be the cause of Anna Pavlovna's coolness? Yes, she mused, there was something unnatural about Anna Pavlovna, and utterly unlike her good nature when she said angrily the day before yesterday, "There, he will keep waiting for you. He wouldn't drink his coffee without you, though he's grown so dreadfully weak." Yes, perhaps, too, she didn't like it when I gave him the rug. It was all so simple. But he took it so awkwardly, and was so long thanking me that I felt awkward, too. And then that portrait of me he did so well. And most of all, that look of confusion and tenderness. Yes, yes, that's it, Kitty repeated to herself with horror. No, it can't be. It oughtn't to be. He's so much to be pitied, she said to herself directly after. This doubt poisoned the charm of her new life. Chapter 34. Before the end of the water cure, Prince Shcherbatsky, who had gone on from Carlsbad to Baden and Kissingen to Russian friends to get a breath of Russian atmosphere, as he said, came back to his wife and daughter. The views of the prince and of the princess on life abroad were completely opposed. The princess thought everything delightful, and in spite of her established position in Russian society, she tried abroad to be like a European fashionable lady, which she was not, for the simple reason she was a typical Russian gentlewoman. And so she was affected, which did not altogether suit her. The prince, on contrary, thought everything foreign detestable, got sick of European life, kept to his Russian habits, and purposely tried to show himself abroad less European than he was in reality. The prince returned thinner, with the skin hanging in loose bags on his cheeks, but in the most cheerful frame of mind. His good humor was even greater when he saw Kitty completely recovered. The news of Kitty's friendship with Madame Stahl and Varenka, and the reports the princess gave him of some kind of change she had noticed in Kitty, troubled the prince and aroused his habitual feeling of jealousy of everything that drew his daughter away from him, and a dread that his daughter might have got out of the reach of his influence into regions inaccessible to him. But this unpleasant news was all drowned in the sea of kindliness and good humor which was always within him, and more so than ever since his course of Carlsbad waters. The day after his arrival, the prince, in his long overcoat, with his Russian wrinkles and baggy cheeks propped up by a starched collar, set off with his daughter to the spring in the greatest good humor. It was a lovely morning. The tidy, cheerful houses with their little gardens, the sight of the red-faced, red-armed, beer-drinking German waitresses working away merrily, and bright sun did one's heart good. But the nearer they got to the springs, the oftener they met sick people, and their appearance seemed more pitiable than ever among the everyday conditions of prosperous German life. Kitty was no longer struck by this contrast. The bright sun, the brilliant green of the foliage, the strains of the music were for her the natural setting of all these familiar faces, with their changes to greater emaciation or to convalescence for which she watched. But to the prince, the brightness and gaiety of the June morning and the sound of the orchestra playing a gay waltz then in fashion, and above all, the appearance of the robust waitresses, seemed something unseemly and monstrous in conjunction with the slowly moving cadavers gathered together from all parts of Europe. In spite of his feeling of pride and, as it were, of the return of youth, when he walked with his favorite daughter on his arm, he felt awkward and almost ashamed of his vigorous step and his sturdy, stout, and fat limbs. He felt almost like a man not dressed in a crowd. Present me to your new friends, he said to his daughter, squeezing her hand with his elbow. I like even your horrid Soden for making you so well again. Only it's melancholy, very melancholy here. Who's that? Kitty mentioned the names of all the people they met, of some with whom she was acquainted, and some with whom she was not. At the very entrance of the garden, they met the blind lady, Madame Bertha, with her guide, and the prince was delighted to see the old French woman's face light up when she heard Kitty's voice. She at once began talking to him with the exaggerated politeness of the French, applauding him for having such a delightful daughter, extolling Kitty to the skies before her face, and calling her a treasure, a pearl, and a consoling angel. Well, she's the second angel, then, said the prince, smiling. She calls Mademoiselle Varenko angel number one. Oh, Mademoiselle Varenko, she's a real angel, allez, Madame Bertha assented. In the arcade, they met Varenka herself. She was walking rapidly toward them, carrying an elegant red bag. Here is Papa come, Kitty said to her. Varenka made, simply and naturally, as she did everything, a movement between a bow and curtsy, and immediately began talking to the prince without shyness, naturally, as she talked to everyone. Oh, of course I know you. I know you very well, the prince said to her with a smile in which Kitty detected with joy that her father liked her friend. Where are you off to in such haste? Mama's here, she said, turning to Kitty. She has not slept all night, and the doctor advised her to go out. I'm taking her work. So that's angel number one, said the prince when Varenka had gone on. Kitty saw that her father had meant to make fun of Varenka, but that he could not do it because he liked her. Come, so we shall see all your friends, he went on, even Madame Stahl, if she deigns to recognize me. Why, did you know her, Papa? Kitty asked apprehensively, catching the gleam of irony that kindled in the prince's eye at the mention of Madame Stahl. I used to know her husband, and her too a little, before she joined the Pietists. What is a Pietist, Papa? Asked Kitty, dismayed to find that what she prized so highly in Madame Stahl had a name. I don't quite know myself. I only know that she thanks God for everything, for every misfortune, and thanks God, too, that her husband died. And that's rather droll, as they didn't get on together. Who's that? What a piteous face, he asked, noticing a sick man of medium height sitting on a bench, wearing a brown overcoat and white trousers that fell in strange folds about his long, fleshless legs. This man lifted his straw hat, showed his scanty, curly hair and high forehead, painfully reddened by the pressure of the hat. That's Petrov, an artist, answered Kitty, blushing. And that's his wife, he added, indicating Anna Pavlovna, who, as though on purpose, at the very instant they approached, walked away after a child that had run off along a path. Poor fellow, and what a fine face he has, said the prince. Why don't you go up to him? He wanted to speak to you. Well, let us go then, said Kitty, turning round resolutely. How are you feeling today? She asked Petrov. Petrov got up, leaning on his stick, and looked shyly at the prince. This is my daughter, said the prince. Let me introduce myself. The painter bowed and smiled, showing his strangely dazzling white teeth. We expected you yesterday, princess, he said to Kitty. He staggered as he said this and then repeated the motion, trying to make it seem as if it had been intentional. I meant to come, but Varenka said that Anna Pavlovna sent word you were not going. Not going, said Petrov, flushing and immediately beginning to cough, and his eyes sought his wife. Anita, Anita, he said loudly, and the swollen veins stood out like cords on his thin white neck. Anna Pavlovna came up. So you sent word to the princess that we weren't going, he whispered to her angrily, losing his voice. Good morning, princess, said Anna Pavlovna with an assumed smile, utterly unlike her former manner. Very glad to make your acquaintance, she said to the prince. You've long been expected, prince. Why did you send word to the princess we weren't going? The artist whispered hoarsely again, Still more angrily, obviously exasperated that his voice failed him so that he could not give his words the expression he would have liked to. "Oh, mercy on us, I thought we weren't going," his wife answered crossly. "What? When?" he coughed and waved his hand. The prince took off his hat and moved away with his daughter. "Ah," he sighed deeply. "Oh, poor things." "Yes, Papa," answered Kitty, "and you must know they've 3 children, no servant, and scarcely any means. He gets something from the academy," she went on briskly, trying to drown the distress that queer change in Anna Pavlovna's manner toward her had aroused in her. "Oh, here's Madame Stahl," said Kitty, indicating an invalid carriage, where, propped on pillows, something in gray and blue was lying under a sunshade. This was Madame Stahl. Beside her stood the gloomy, robust German workman who pushed the carriage. Close by was standing a flaxen-headed Swedish count, whom Kitty knew by name. Several invalids were lingering near the low carriage, staring at the lady as though she were some curiosity. The prince walked up to her, and Kitty detected that disconcerting gleam of irony in his eyes. He walked up to Madame Stahl and addressed her with extreme courtesy and charm in that excellent French which so few speak nowadays. "I don't know if you remember me, but I must recall myself to thank you for your kindness to my daughter," he said, taking off his hat and not putting it on again. "Prince Andrei Shcherbatsky," said Madame Stahl, lifting upon him her heavenly eyes, in which Kitty discerned a look of annoyance. "Delighted. I have taken a great fancy to your daughter." "You are still in weak health?" "Yes, I'm used to it," said Madame Stahl, and she introduced the prince to the Swedish count. "You are scarcely changed at all," the prince said to her. "It's 10 or 11 years since I had the honor of seeing you." "Yes, God sends the cross and sends the strength to bear it. Often one wonders what is the goal of this life." "The other side," she said angrily to Varenka, who has rearranged the rug over her feet, not to her satisfaction. "To do good, probably," said the prince with a twinkle in his eye. "That is not for us to judge," said Madame Stahl, perceiving the shade of expression on the prince's face. "So you will send me that book, dear count? I'm very grateful to you," she said to the young Swede. "Ah," cried the prince, catching sight of the Moscow colonel standing near, and with a bow to Madame Stahl, he walked away with his daughter and the Moscow colonel, who joined them. "That's our aristocracy, prince," the Moscow colonel said with ironical intention. He cherished a grudge against Madame Stahl for not making his acquaintance. "She's the same as ever," replied the prince. "Did you know her before her illness, prince? That's to say, before she took to her bed?" "Yes, she took to her bed before my eyes," said the prince. "They say it's 10 years since she has stood on her feet. She doesn't stand up because her legs are too short. She has a very bad figure." "Papa, it's not possible," cried Kitty. "That's what wicked tongues say, my darling, and your Varenka is to endure still," he added. "Oh, these invalid ladies." "Oh, no, Papa," Kitty objected warmly. "Varenka worships her, and then she does so much good. Ask anyone. Everyone knows her and Aline Stahl." "Perhaps so," said the prince, squeezing her hand with his elbow. "But it's better when one does good, so that you may ask everyone and no one knows." Kitty did not answer, not because she had nothing to say, but because she did not care to reveal her secret thoughts, even to her father. But strange to say, although she had made up her mind so firmly not to be influenced by her father's views, not to let him into her inmost sanctuary, she felt that the heavenly image of Madame Stahl, which she had carried for a whole month in her heart, had vanished, never to return. Just as the fantastic figure made up of some clothes thrown down at random vanishes when one sees that it is only some fallen garment. All that was left was a woman with short legs, who lay down because she had a bad figure, and worried patient Varenka for not arranging her rug to her liking. And by no effort of her imagination could Kitty bring back the former Madame Stahl. Chapter 35. The prince communicated his good humor to his own family and his friends, and even to the German landlord in whose rooms the Shcherbatskys were staying. On coming back with Kitty from the Springs, the prince, who had asked the colonel and Maria Eugenievna and Varenka all to come and have coffee with them, gave orders for a table and chairs to be taken into the tiny garden under the chestnut tree, and lunch to be laid there. The landlord and the servants, too, grew brisker under the influence of his good spirits. They knew his open-handedness, and half an hour later the invalid doctor from Hamburg, who lived on the top floor, looked enviously out of his window at the merry party of healthy Russians assembled under the chestnut tree. In the trembling circles of shadow cast by the leaves, at a table covered with a white cloth, and set with coffee pot, bread, butter, cheese, and cold game, sat the princess in a high cap with lilac ribbons, distributing cups and sandwiches. At the other end sat the prince, eating heartily and talking loudly and merrily. The prince had spread out near him his purchases, carved boxes and knick-knacks and paper knives of all sorts, of which he had bought a heap at every watering place, and bestowed them upon everyone, including Lieschen, the servant girl, and the landlord, with whom he jested in his comically bad German, assuring him that it was not the water had cured Kitty, but his splendid cookery, especially his plum soup. The princess laughed at her husband for his Russian ways, but she was more lively and good-humored than she had been all the while she had been at the waters. The colonel smiled, as he always did, at the prince's jokes, but as far as regards Europe, of which he believed himself to be making a careful study, he took the princess's side. The good-hearted Maria Eugenievna simply roared with laughter at everything absurd the princess said, and his jokes made Varenka helpless with feeble but infectious laughter, which was something Kitty had never seen before. Kitty was glad of all this, but she could not be light-hearted. She could not solve the problem her father had unconsciously set her by his good-humored view of her friends and of the life that had so attracted her. To this doubt there was joined the change in her relations with the Petrovs, which had been so conspicuously and unpleasantly marked that morning. Everyone was good-humored, but Kitty could not feel good-humored, and this increased her distress. She felt a feeling such as she had known in childhood, when she had been shut in her room as a punishment, and had heard her sister's merry laughter outside. "Well, but what did you buy this mass of things for?" said the princess, smiling and handing her husband a cup of coffee. "One goes for a walk, one looks in a shop, and they ask you to buy Erlacht, Excellency, Durlacht. Directly they say Durlacht, I can't hold out, and 10 thalers are gone." "It's simply from boredom," said the princess. "Of course it is. Such boredom, my dear, that one doesn't know what to do with oneself." "How can you be bored, Prince? There's so much that's interesting now in Germany," said Maria Eugenievna. "But I know everything that's interesting. The plum soup I know, and the pea sausages I know. I know everything." "No, you may say what you like, Prince. There's the interest of their institutions," said the colonel. "But what is there interesting? They're all as beaming with joy as brass halfpence. They've conquered everybody. And why am I to be pleased at that? I haven't conquered anyone. Only I have myself to take off my own boots, and besides to expose them before the door. In the morning get up and dress at once and go to the coffee room to drink bad tea. How different it is at home. You get up no haste, you get cross, grumble a little, come around again. You've time to think things over, and no hurry." "But time's money, you forget that," said the colonel. "Time indeed. Why, there are times one would give a month of for half a ruble, and times you wouldn't get half an hour of for any money. Isn't that so, Katenka? What is it? Why are you so depressed?" "I'm not depressed." "Where are you off to? Stay a little longer," he said to Varenka. "I must be going home," said Varenka, getting up, and again she broke out laughing. When she had recovered, she said goodbye and went into the house to get her hat. Kitty followed her. Even Varenka struck her as different. She was not inferior, but different from what she had fancied her before. "Oh, dear, it's a long while since I laughed so much," said Varenka, gathering up her parasol and her handbag. "What a dear your father is." Kitty did not speak. "When shall I see you again?" asked Varenka. "Mama meant to go and see the Petrovs. Won't you be there?" said Kitty to try Varenka. "Yes," answered Varenka. "They're getting ready to go away, so I promised to help them pack." "Well, I'll come too, then." "No, why should you?" "Why not? Why not? Why not?" said Kitty, opening her eyes wide and clutching at Varenka's parasol so as not to let her go. "No, wait a minute. Why not?" "Oh, nothing. Your father has come, and besides, they will feel awkward at your helping." "No, tell me why you don't want me to be often at the Petrovs." "You don't want me to. Why not?" "I didn't say that," said Varenka quietly. "No, please tell me." "Tell you everything?" asked Varenka. "Everything, everything," Kitty assented. "Well, there's really nothing of any consequence, only that Mikhail Alexievich, that was the artist's name, had meant to leave earlier, and now he doesn't want to go away," said Varenka, smiling. "Go on, go on," Kitty urged impatiently, looking somberly at Varenka. "Well, and for some reason Anna Pavlovna told him that he didn't want to go because you are here. Of course, that was nonsense, but there was a dispute over it, over you. You know how irritable these sick people are. Kitty, scowling more than ever, kept silent, and Varenka went on speaking alone, trying to soften or soothe her, and seeing a storm coming, she did not know whether of tears or of words. So you'd better not go. You understand? You won't be offended? And it serves me right. And it serves me right, Kitty cried quickly, snatching the parasol out of Varenka's hand and avoiding looking at her friend's face. Varenka felt inclined to smile, looking at her friend's childish fury, but she was afraid of wounding her. How does it serve you right? I don't understand, she said. It serves me right because it was all sham, because it was all done on purpose and not from the heart. What business had I to interfere with outsiders? And so it's come about that I'm the cause of a quarrel, and that I've done what nobody asked me to do, because it was all a sham, a sham, a sham. A sham? With what object? Said Varenka gently. Oh, it's so idiotic, so hateful. There was no need whatever for me. Nothing but sham, she said, opening and shutting the parasol. But with what object? To seem better to people, to myself, to God, to deceive everyone. No, now I won't descend to that. One could be bad, but anyway, not a liar, not a cheat. But who is a cheat? Said Varenka reproachfully. You speak as if... But Kitty was in one of her gusts of fury, and she would not let her finish. I don't talk about you, not about you at all. You're perfection. Yes, yes, I know you're all perfection, but what am I to do if I'm bad? This would never have been if I weren't bad. So let me be what I am, but not to be a sham. What have I to do with Anna Pavlovna? Let them go their way, and me go mine. I can't be different, and yet it's not that. It's not that. What is it? Asked Varenka in bewilderment. Everything. I can't act except from the heart, and you act from principle. I simply liked you, but you most likely only wanted to save me, to improve me. You are unjust, said Varenka. But I'm not speaking of other people, I'm speaking of myself. Kitty, they heard her mother's voice, come here, show Papa your necklace. Kitty, with a haughty air, without making peace with her friend, took the necklace in a little box from the table and went to her mother. What's the matter? Why are you so red? Her mother and father said to her with one voice. Nothing, she answered. I'll be back directly, and she ran back. She's still here, she thought. What am I to say to her? Oh, dear. What have I done? What have I said? Why was I rude to her? What am I to do? What am I to say to her? Thought Kitty, and she stopped in the doorway. Varenka, in her hat with the parasol in her hands, was sitting at a table examining the parasol spring which Kitty had broken. She lifted her head. Varenka, forgive me. Do forgive me, whispered Kitty, going up to her. I don't remember what I said. I really didn't mean to hurt you, said Varenka, smiling. Peace was made. But with her father's coming, all the world in which she had been living was transformed for Kitty. She did not give up everything she had learned, but she became aware that she had deceived herself in supposing she could be what she wanted to be. Her eyes were, it seemed, open. She felt all the difficulty of maintaining herself without hypocrisy and self-conceit on the pinnacle of which she had wished to mount. Moreover, she became aware of all the dreariness of the world of sorrow, of sick and dying people, in which she had been living. The efforts she had made to like it seemed to her intolerable, and she felt a longing to get back quickly into the fresh air, to Russia, to Ergushova, where, as she knew from letters, her sister Dolly had already gone with her children. But her affection for Varenka did not wane. Parting, Kitty begged her to come to them in Russia. I'll come when you're married, said Varenka. I shall never marry. Well, then, I shall never come. Well, then, I shall be married simply for that. Mind now. Remember your promise, said Kitty. The doctor's prediction was fulfilled. Kitty returned home to Russia cured. She was not as gay and thoughtless as before, but she was serene. Her Moscow troubles had become a memory to her. Part 3, Chapter 1. Sergei Ivanovich Kazanashev wanted a rest from mental work, and instead of going abroad as he usually did, he came toward the end of May to stay in the country with his brother. In his judgment, the best sort of life was a country life. He had come now to enjoy such a life at his brother's. Konstantin Levin was very glad to have him, especially as he did not expect his brother Nikolai that summer. But in spite of his affection and respect for Sergei Ivanovich, Konstantin Levin was uncomfortable with his brother in the country. It made him uncomfortable, and it even annoyed him to see his brother's attitude to the country. To Konstantin Levin, the country was the background of life, that is, of pleasures, endeavors, labor. To Sergei Ivanovich, the country meant, on one hand, rest from work, on the other, a valuable antidote to laxness, an antidote which he took with satisfaction and a sense of its salutariness. To Konstantin Levin, the country was good because it afforded a field for labor, of the usefulness of which there could be no doubt. To Sergei Ivanovich, the country was particularly good because there it was possible and fitting to do nothing. Moreover, Sergei Ivanovich's attitude toward the people rather piqued Konstantin. Sergei Ivanovich used to say that he knew and liked the people, and he often talked to the peasants, which he knew how to do without affectation or condescension, and from every such conversation he would deduce general conclusions in favor of the people, and in confirmation of his knowing them. Konstantin Levin did not like such an attitude toward the people. To Konstantin, the people was simply the chief partner in the common labor, and in spite of all the respect and the love, almost like that of kinship, he had for the peasant, sucked in probably as he himself, with the milk of his peasant nurse. Konstantin, as a fellow worker with them, while sometimes enthusiastic over the vigor, gentleness, and justice of these men, was very often, when their common labors called for other qualities, exasperated with the peasant for his carelessness, slovenliness, drunkenness, and lying. If he had been asked whether he liked or didn't like the people, Konstantin Levin would have been absolutely at a loss what to reply. He liked and did not like the people, just as he liked and did not like men in general. Of course, being a good-hearted man, he liked men more than he disliked them, and so too with the people.